Good evening and welcome to City Visions at our new time, 6 p.m. on Monday night. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. As protests against racial injustice and police violence continue across the country, Bay Area cities are now considering measures to reform, defund, or even dismantle their police forces. What will it take to build trust between our communities and law enforcement? Later this hour, I'll address that question with a panel of experts on the front lines of police reform. And then our final segment will feature artist Ori Original, creator of the Justice for Our Lives portrait series, depicting people who have been killed by the police. But first, as shelter-in-place orders across the country continue to be relaxed, coronavirus cases are on the rise. California recorded its highest one-day total last Thursday, only to record an even higher number on Friday. And the story is the same across much of the country, with over 20 states seeing a rise in their average number of daily cases last week. Here to explain and interpret the latest news on the COVID front, I'm pleased to be joined once again by Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thank you for having me again.
And we're also joined by Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan. And hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Glad to have you both. You are a dynamic duo on all things COVID related. So we're pleased you can provide an update. And Aaron, let me start with you. We heard over the weekend that daily case counts of COVID were rising in over 20 states, as I just mentioned, including California. But what are we seeing here in the Bay Area counties?
So we're also seeing, you know, the case counts are increasing. And when we talk about case counts, I think it's important to keep reminding people we're talking about the number of new cases reported, you know, day after day. So obviously the total cumulative count is going to keep climbing over time because that's the cumulative count. But what we're seeing is just sort of, you know, day to day, week to week, we're seeing these increases in numbers. I will say the Bay Area has been sort of up and down kind of over the last month or so. We're on somewhat of an upward kind of, you know, pickup in recent weeks since things started to reopen. It's not as dramatic as what we're seeing in the entire state of California. And it does seem like it may be tapering off or at least getting kind of under control, but it kind of varies a lot day to day and week to week. So it can be a little bit hard to get a sense of where we are with that exactly, to be perfectly honest.
Well, and Aaron, I definitely agree. It's hard to keep track of everything and you have historic cases that are sort of bundled in with active cases. And it seems to me that hospitalization rates may be one of the most important indicators. So, Peter, I wanted to ask you, what are we seeing in terms of any increase in hospitalizations in San Francisco?
Well, in San Francisco, and I would say in the UCSF system, we've not been short of patients, that's for sure. We've kind of hovered in a little bit less than 20. And right now, amongst the hospitals, at the medical center, we actually have a few more patients than the general, which is, you know, again, for the first time in the epidemic, usually the general had been a little bit more than UCSF medical center. So again, you know, not surpassing our capacity, but again, we're sort of nervous and we're looking and we're watching.
Does it seem, Peter, that things are starting to kind of hit from the Memorial Day weekend now? Are you worried this is going to be an upward trend, perhaps through the rest of the month and maybe beyond if we continue reopening as we have been?
I think that surge would have hit already around now. So I think that we kind of weathered through that. So I think, you know, I agree with Aaron that, you know, we'll continue to sort of watch and wait and see what the gradual reopening will do. And again, we expect more cases with reopening. It's just, again, the matter of can we take care of all the patients, and we need to do safely.
And Aaron, we're seeing some of our neighboring states getting worse in terms of their number of cases. Arizona, for example, their largest hospital system warned that they could see a shortage of ICU beds after daily cases just tripled in the last 2 weeks. And the governor there, Ducey, says that the state is ready for the climbing numbers and has decided to just continue with their reopening. And he's not requiring any masks for people in Arizona. Now, are we seeing anything at the state level here where Governor Newsom is starting to show any reluctance to continue with the reopening, given the trajectory we're seeing here in California and in other states?
Not at all. In fact, Governor Newsom had a media briefing today where he kind of went back and said that the California is continuing apace with reopening. And, you know, I will say, and he points out a lot of numbers to back this up, that California is in a very different place than other states. So even though we're seeing this increase in cases, which is undoubtedly there in California, You know, the governor will say, and it's true that a lot of that is due to increased testing. We have dramatically expanded testing in California. And what they're saying is that the positivity rate, so the percent of people who test positive, has been hovering between about 4% and 5% in recent weeks, which is a pretty low number and kind of where they want it to be to feel safe. But, you know, the hospitalization rates statewide have been pretty stable. And even when we see upticks, the truth is we have a lot of capacity. What they talk about is one of the goals of sheltering in place was, aside from keeping the case counts and the death numbers low, but it was also to give the hospitals time to prepare to really build up, you know, that capacity. So to make sure that they had, you know, beds for all the folks who needed it, that they could build up the ventilators and just kind of make sure that they have space for everyone should we see a giant increase in cases. And so they're feeling comfortable that between the testing now and the hospital situation, and then also building up the contact tracing program, that the numbers that we're seeing increase recently are kind of within reason to keep under control. And so the governor says that he feels confident to keep with the same kind of pace of reopening. And he also points out that the counties, you know, really this is at the county level these decisions are made. So even though the whole state is sort of allowed to reopen to a certain point, you know, the counties have shown that they will kind of control how fast that will move on the local level, depending on what they see happening in their communities.
And Aaron, on this point of the reopening, then what are we seeing in terms of sort of the latest announcements? I did see that there are new guidelines now for reopening of nail salons and tattoo parlors, massage businesses, and other beauty services. And they're supposed to open, I gather, on Friday, June 19th. So where are we at in terms of what's the next phase of reopening?
Well, we're right now, so for the kind of fast track counties, so the ones that have applied to move ahead of the state schedule, which is sort of funny at this point because that's 52 out of 58 counties. So really the bulk of the state is on that kind of fast track schedule, though not most of the Bay Area. But yeah, that's been the latest is allowing those sort of personal care services. So, you know, really anything that involves up close kind of personal, you know, touching of you know, the face or the body. So massage parlors, tattoo, nail salons, those kinds of places are now allowed to reopen in these counties that have moved ahead of things as soon as Friday. And I'm told that a lot of counties will begin allowing that. And those are considered kind of this stage three or phase three is what what the state is calling. So they're moving on into that phase three. Most of the Bay Area is still in this phase two place. It's easy to lose track, but you know, now we're getting some indoor retail, like in San Francisco, the malls, Westfield just opened up today, some other businesses opened up. Some of the North Bay counties, you know, have had indoor dining now. Outdoor dining, I think, is allowed pretty much, I probably shouldn't say everywhere, I'm probably going to be wrong about that, but it's allowed in most everywhere in the Bay Area now. So, you know, we're definitely seeing an opening up. And not to plug the Chronicle, but we do have a tracker on our website, sfchronicle.com, that has information by county to help people make sense of what's actually happening in their community, because I lose track all the time. But the point is that we're definitely seeing, you know, things are progressing, things are moving ahead. Even San Francisco County, San Francisco today is talking about applying for that fast track status. So they're talking about applying to the state to be able to move at a slightly faster clip. So we're seeing more of that going on too.
And Aaron, at the national level, in terms of reopening, I see the CDC, Center for Disease Control, came out with additional guidelines to guide behavior out in public. So anything new in the recommendations from the CDC that caught your attention?
Well, what caught my attention was simply hearing from the CDC, to be honest. The CDC has been really remarkably absent kind of in a public place from kind of talking to people and giving out guidance. They've had a lot of guidance on their website, but haven't really communicated directly with the public about it. So they had their first media briefing since March last Friday to talk about this new guidance. Aside from that, you know, the folks I talked to, it mentioned that the guidance felt very familiar to those of us in the Bay Area, because frankly, it's what we've been told all along, which is if you're going to go out and about now as things reopen, you should be wearing masks, you should be washing your hands really often, you should be not touching other people, keeping 6 feet away, you know, no handshakes, no hugs, no anything like that. I thought it was interesting that the CDC talked about kind of what to do if you're going to large gatherings, which they didn't talk about this specifically. They were asked about it, but didn't really refer to it. But, you know, protests and political rallies, with those potentially starting up next week or maybe this week, you know, they didn't say don't do those things. They mentioned that they're very high risk, but then said, if you're going to do that, here are some things you should do, which I think, again, most folks in the Bay Area are familiar with at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, let me turn to you and ask about treatments, medicine, vaccines, et cetera. I just saw that the FDA withdrew their emergency approval for a couple of the malaria drugs that President Trump had promoted for treatment of the coronavirus. Can you?
In a dramatic move, yes.
It's very, very dramatic, I'm sure, for people who hopefully weren't necessarily taking medical advice from the president at this stage. But why did the drugs lose their emergency approval?
Because they never should have gotten it in the first place. If you look at the story of remdesivir, which we've talked about here before, which is that Gilead drug, a modestly effective antiviral drug, we had the data, then we got the emergency use authorization from the FDA, which allowed Gilead to give and donate their stocks to the government, and we can use it like a national stockpile. In the case of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, it was reverse. We had the emergency use authorization before there was any data. And there was this national stockpile because the drug companies donated drug and then people were using it, but they were using it in a vacuum. So in a sense, it was science prevailing after multiple well-done studies this time show that there was no benefit in using it for treatment.
So in other words, maybe undoing a mistake there with rescinding that emergency approval.
Yeah, and misstep.
And Peter, Aaron's paper, The Chronicle, reported today that neutralizing antibodies that prevent COVID-19 from entering cells have been found in fewer than 5% of the patients, but may be key to lasting immunity and potentially to the development of an effective vaccine. Can you tell us a little bit about these antibodies and why they may be so important?
I think when people say the word vaccine, it could be confusing because there are two ways that we think about vaccines. One is passive immunization. So it's like you're giving somebody else's immune cells. And that's called a vaccine too, because we do it for rabies. We do it for hepatitis A. In the old days before the vaccine, people would go abroad and we'd give them immune globulin to protect them for 3 months. So it's the same idea of passive immunity. What that doesn't do is give you durable immunity. So you don't make anything on your own. So that when that person's antibodies goes away, it goes away for good. In the sort of like the vaccine development, that's active immunity. And we're making something that will stimulate your immune cells to make antibodies on its own. And that's going to be much more durable. But the problem is that's some ways away. So the reason why people are getting excited about this idea that we could find these elite antibodies, these neutralizing antibodies, is that we could potentially make it in a lab or select people who have them naturally, which is not the vast majority of people, and then infuse them into people like a temporary vaccine or even like a treatment, like a virus stun gun. So that's why I think people are excited about it, but we need to study it.
All right. So it's potentially some good news, but definitely more time than it sounds like to wait for the development of a vaccine. Aaron, I wanted to go back to you as we're talking about other states and seeing a big rise in places like Texas and Arizona. How can California in the long run really make progress keeping our population healthy and safe if we're going to have free travel from places around the U.S. that are experiencing these outbreaks? Is there a concern that, you know, we can only sort of do so much here in the state given the lack of progress in so many other parts of the states?
That's definitely a concern. It's been a concern since kind of day one that you know, of shelter in place in California, that is as hard as we're working here and as good a job as we might be doing and keeping things low, you know, we're always going to be at risk of what's happening in the rest of the country. I think that, again, goes back to the importance of having that kind of testing and contact tracing infrastructure in place. So the idea being that even if we do get kind of constantly reseeded by visitors from out of state, so, you know, people, you know, visiting from Arizona, people, I mean, coming to Disneyland, right? Disneyland's going to be reopening, all of that, that even if you get like a case or two resulting from that, if you can test folks real fast and identify them and get them, you know, isolated and then kind of get any of their contacts in quarantine, then you can keep those from kind of spiraling into new big outbreaks. So that's definitely the hope here. And that's just, I mean, honestly, that's just what it's going to take. We can't close our borders down. It's just not reasonable for a lot of reasons. So that's, you know, we're just going to kind of have to live with that scenario. That's the impression I get anyway.
All right. Well, and Peter, last question for you. What are you looking forward to, or what are you sort of monitoring story-wise on COVID that we should be looking at as well over the next week? Any big indicators or medical advancements worth tracking?
Well, I think that, you know, the next few weeks we'll see us really try to hone in on figuring out better therapies. I think a lot of people are still excited about antibodies as therapy for convalescent plasma. I think the one thing we haven't talked about is as the cases go up in the hospital, we still do have very limited supplies of remdesivir. Gilead hasn't really ramped it up because the FDA hasn't given formal clearance. So I think people will be thinking about what do we have and how can we use that to treat the patients if we get a surge.
All right. Well, I want to thank both our guests, Aaron Alday, health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. And thank you, Peter.
Thanks so much, Aaron. And I think I should have a name beginning with E the next time.
And that's also Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Thanks so much for joining us. And up next, we're going to have a panel on local efforts to reimagine law enforcement. In response to the killing of George Floyd and the ensuing protests against police violence, cities here in the Bay Area, like many across the nation, have begun to address how their systems have failed the communities they're supposed to protect. Last week, San Francisco Mayor London Breed laid out four goals for addressing racial injustice and police brutality. Under the blueprint, police would no longer be called for non-criminal activities, and the reforms would additionally fortify accountability policies. They'd ban the use of military-grade weapons and divert funding to communities of color. Oakland and San Jose leaders have also proposed additional reforms. Meanwhile, many protesters have called for cities to defund the police, hoping that dollars might instead go to support social services and other programs within affected communities. But are these efforts enough? Or are the problems now so embedded that the only solution is to dismantle our current law enforcement system and start anew? To discuss these questions and more, I'm pleased to be joined by Matthew Barge, police practices and civil rights expert at 21CP Solutions. He's also senior consultant with the Policing Project at the NYU School of Law. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Kat Brooks, an activist and co-founder of Anti-Police Terror Project and executive director of Justice Teams Network. Welcome, Kat.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, I'm pleased to be joined by Malia Cohen, member of the California State Board of Equalization and former president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors for the city and county of San Francisco. So welcome, Board Member Cohen.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you all.
And I want to let all of you know, our listeners, that we invite you to join the conversation. You can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. We want to hear from you. If you're in favor of reforming, defunding, or dismantling the police, what do you think it will take to build trust between law enforcement and our communities? Again, that number is 866-798-TALK. Well, Matthew, let me start with you. In your work with 21CP Solutions, an organization focusing on public safety solutions for the 21st century, you've overseen police reform efforts across the country, including in Baltimore, Chicago, and more locally here at Sacramento. So what issues are you seeing in police departments nationwide now?
I mean, I think what I'm seeing, you know, are the types of issues that the entire country can't help but see at this point. I think, you know, when you go to, I think any police department, you are struck by the fact that force is used disproportionately against Black people. When you look at who's stopped by the police, that's disproportionately Black people in every jurisdiction that I've looked at. I think you see some police departments that at least give lip service to implementing some of the meaningful types of reforms that we know maybe can work, as far as, you know, being implemented today to try to save some lives tomorrow. These are you know, some of the things that you hear about in terms of the Eight Can't Wait, you know, campaign, things like banning chokeholds, requiring de-escalation, that sort of thing. But, you know, in most of the police departments that have tried to implement some of those reforms or tried to implement, you know, the reforms of the last major blue ribbon commission on police reform we had in this country, the task force that President Obama put together, one survey suggested that only 40% of large police departments had implemented any of the recommendations of that task force, let alone doing all of the sorts of, you know, very basic things in terms of policies and procedures and protocols to, you know, again, try to change practices to make policing not as deadly as it is to Black folks. So I think when you look at what has spilled into the public sphere for everyone, it is what communities of color, and particularly the Black community, know all too well and have known, you know, all too well for too long. And that is that, you know, police has a systemic racism problem. And I think that this particular moment is the time that we have to confront that head on.
And Matthew, let's kind of set the scene a little bit here. I mean, our country has 18,000 police agencies. So this is a very diverse and diffuse problem here. Who sets the rules for all of these different police agencies? And what role do state, local, and national government play in holding police departments accountable?
I mean, you know, the police fundamentally make their own rules as far as the policy of the police department, and then hold themselves accountable. I mean, you know, really the police, I guess, go into a conference room without any input from the folks who they are serving, the communities that they are tasked with serving. You know, they just make the rules, figure out what they're going to do, and then, you know, ostensibly hold themselves, quote unquote, accountable for following them, right? Obviously, we have state and federal laws, constitutional protections, and civil rights regulations. But, you know, as people have begun to really focus in on our use of force standards at the federal level, you know, Supreme Court has completely dropped the ball on giving clear and precise expectations for officers on what they can and cannot do. It's a very muddled, you know, standard of reasonableness, and that hasn't served us well. It's too difficult to criminally charge, let alone civilly, you know, sue a police officer for their actions. And it really means that, you know, the sort of the what, instead of systems of overlapping accountability, we have no system of accountability.
Well, let's talk about closer to home here in San Francisco. And Board Member Cohen, I wanted to turn to you on this. So you were on our program back in 2015 after the police shooting of Mario Woods in the Bayview. And just to give us a sort of local perspective on this, first of all, can you tell us about the death of Mario Woods, what happened there? And then since you were on the Board of Supervisors at the time, what was San Francisco's response, and you know, what has changed since then?
Sure. A lot has changed, actually. Thanks for bringing me back on. So back in 2015, in December, many people may recall Mario Woods was a young man walking down the street of 3rd Street, and he was carrying a gun. SFPD gave several orders to drop the gun. Ultimately, the knife. He had a knife. Ultimately, he was killed by a barrage of 22 bullets. And images captured look like a firing squad. If I remember correctly, it's either 6 or 7 officers all drew their weapons and fired collectively and riddled this young man's body with bullets. And for me, it was a very, very pivotal point in my career. It actually motivated me to start to introduce a series of legislation as well as policy changes within the police department. Working with then Chief Greg Suhr, the police commission, and trying to change the use of force policies. And what I was shocked to learn was at that particular time, our use of force policies hadn't been touched in 25 years. 25 years, these department general orders were on the books, and that is what was used, that was the tool that was used to govern the SFPD at use of force policies. And as a result of Mario Woods and that shooting, not only were we able to successfully ban re-envision what use of force policies would look like, but we were also successful in banning chokeholds. Many of the 8 reforms that that you see in the 8 Can't Wait that Matthew had referenced, we implemented in 2016. So that means like de-escalation, requiring officers to give warnings before shooting, exhausting all alternatives before shooting, and maintaining a duty to intervene, de-escalation, as well as also providing our officers with anti-bias training, as well as CIT training, which is crisis intervention training. The changing the use of force continuum, and then most importantly, requiring comprehensive reporting. So as a result, I brought to voters in 2016 Proposition G, which created a Department of Police Accountability. And this Department of Police Accountability has been very successful in prosecuting officers that are found to do wrong. But most importantly, it gives this department autonomy and independence. Whenever there's an officer-involved shooting, there is an independent investigation done outside of the police department. So they also have an auditing function, too, because it's important to know where and how PD dollars are being spent.
And Board Member Cohen, given these reforms, how would you describe the state now of the relationship between San Francisco's Black community in particular and the police department? Do you feel like these reforms have helped make a difference on the ground now?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, and the answer is probably nuanced. In many ways, the reforms have done well because we've had 2 officer-involved shootings in 2 years, which is a significant decrease than where we were before we initiated these initiatives back in 2016. We are fortunate to have a police chief that gets it and is working with us on dismantling bias within the department. However, I'm sure that there are people in the community, as a matter of fact, I know for a fact, that still believe that we haven't gone far enough and that there is still work to be done. And I would agree with that. The mayor recently announced last week about the reallocation of dollars towards mental health and community support towards the African-American community. And then, and also in San Francisco, when we're talking about those that are disproportionately stopped and searched by law enforcement, that also includes the LGBTQ community. Our transgender community is also incredibly vulnerable. We have lost several trans women's lives, and they have been people of color in the last several years. So as we as a city continue to broaden our perspective of use of force, making sure that we're not forgetting other vulnerable communities along the way. Excuse me.
And it's helpful to hear about the San Francisco perspective. But Kat Brooks, I wanted to turn to you to hear a bit about what's happening in Oakland. You're one of the co-founders of the Anti-Police Terror Project in Oakland and also executive director of Justice Teams Network. Can you describe what your perception of Oakland's relationship with its police department is at this moment, and also a little bit about what your organization is doing on that front?
Sure. So it's really important to understand what's happening in Oakland today within the larger context of OPD's relationship with the Black community and the Brown community. It is tenuous. At best, there is massive mistrust. The Oakland Police Department at one point was the killer police department per capita in all of Northern California. The Vallejo Police Department now has now takes that title. But things haven't gotten much better here. And part of how you can tell that, in 2018, there was an equity indicators report that was actually done by the city of Oakland. And the city itself got a 33 out of 100 in terms of how it's doing around equity. But the Oakland Police Department got a 1 on every single category, from use of force to diversity, you name it. And so we haven't seen a lot of progress, though the city does like to tout that their leadership in terms of police reform. The reason why the numbers of killings by the Oakland Police Department have gone down are not because there's been some fundamental shift inside of the police department. It's because we've collectively built an accountability movement in the streets. And so folks are very clear that if you kill one of us, you're going to have to deal with all of us. In terms of the Anti-Police Terror Project and the work that we're doing, 5 years ago, we introduced the Defund OPD campaign. And what that meant was OPD gets almost 50% of Oakland's general fund. And so we wanted half of that to be redirected into services and resources that actually keep us safe. The data shows that when we have communities that focus on mental health support, dealing with trauma, substance abuse prevention and treatment, housing, quality education, and good jobs, those are the things that actually keep us safe. If we could incarcerate police our way to being a safer state or a safer country, for that matter, we would be the safest place in the world because we incarcerate more people than any other country on the planet and more than most combined. So when we first introduced the campaign, people laughed at us. but each year they took us a little bit more seriously. And now we see that it is the rallying cry of tens of thousands of Oaklanders that are taken to the street. Thousands marched to Libby Schaff's house, the mayor of Oakland. Thousands have taken to the streets repeatedly demanding that we redirect resources from a police department that people don't feel is keeping us very safe, and that we reimagine what public safety looks like, and that it's not about punitive policing, but it's about divesting from that and investing in community.
Well, lots to talk about there in terms of potential reforms, and I definitely want to get to those. I just first want to let listeners know that this is City Visions on Local Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at kalw.org. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and tonight we're discussing efforts to reform, defund, or dismantle police forces here in the Bay Area and beyond. And we want to hear from you. What police reforms would you support? Or do you think we need to scrap the current system and start anew? You can call in to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. And I should let listeners know that we are joined by three guests: Matthew Barge, police practices and civil rights expert at 21 CP Solutions. We're also joined by Kat Brooks, co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, and Malia Cohen, former San Francisco supervisor and current member of the California State Board of Equalization. Well, let's talk about some solutions for reimagining law enforcement. What are some of the options? Matthew Barge, let me start with you. Can you just briefly give listeners an idea of what options for reimagining law enforcement might exist? What are the terms reform, defund, and dismantle even mean?
Well, I think that one way of looking at this is that, there are a number of initiatives, the sorts of things that you hear congressional leaders talking about in the federal package, and some of the things that cities are talking about in terms of police policies and practices. There are a number of reforms that I think we can make today that can save lives tomorrow. This is the eight can't wait reforms, and sort of working within the system that we have, working within the police departments as they're structured now, and thinking about how can we try to ensure that Black folks are not killed at the hands of police officers tomorrow, right? I think there's another part of this conversation, and different people are calling it different things and are coming up with the conceptions of what it means in real time. But it is to reimagine the public safety and community well-being in this country. Police say all the time, in every police department I've ever gone to, police will tell you that they do too much. They're asked to handle problems they're not trained to handle. And I would argue that we should believe them, just like we should believe communities that believe that they are over-policed and they are disproportionately affected by police and police violence. I mean, there are many things that police do on a day-to-day basis, shift-to-shift basis. They answer false burglar alarms. They take incident reports on motor vehicle accidents. They respond to noise complaints. And part of why police do this is that, they're there. They answer the phone. They're there 24/7. But I think that a lot of people, under the defund or the reimagining banner, are starting to have, I think, a really important conversation about how we can invest in community well-being in a way that gives resources to community groups, to social service providers, to respond to problems, to help solve issues that don't require the dispatch of an armed police officer. You know, in Silicon Valley, I think they would call this disrupting the public safety space. So I personally am not sure, why defunding police has become sort of a term that people are uncomfortable with. But at least some people, as I read news reports in some places. But I think having a comprehensive discussion about how we can fundamentally shift the paradigm of how we provide for community well-being is something that is long overdue.
Well, certainly the phrase defund the police has raised a lot of eyebrows, and we had an email comment, shouldn't we be fighting for more funding for the police department instead of defunding? I would like them to have more money for the necessary training and screening to make a better police force. So this is certainly an issue that I think needs a lot more conversation. I first want to go to the phone lines that we have Louise in San Francisco calling in. So Louise, welcome to City Visions. Do we have Louise? Let's see, we'll just stand by and get Louise on the line here.
Hello.
Hi, Louise. Welcome.
No, this is not Louise. That's why this is Melissa. But no, that's not why I'm calling. I'm not calling to hear my name. I'm calling just to say I really appreciate the conversation, and I love the idea of disrupting the police. But, as an institution, I think it should be pointed out that its origins, of course, were as like a slave-catching entity, and there wasn't policing in this country or perhaps anywhere until slavery was created for that purpose. And I think that's part of the point of Michelle Alexander's book. So... knowing that, it doesn't make that much sense to put on top of it another regulatory agency. I think that's just terrible, with all due respect to Ms. Cohen. And I think the thoughts that you all have been throwing around about reimagining are wonderful. And I'd love to see that reimagination of our communities without a militarized police force, without a police force at all, grow so that it can go to the national level, and we can think that way about our federal budget and how we spend our energy and resources on the federal level around, putting so much of the federal budget in essentially the same project, just internationally. So,
yes, well, thank you, Melissa. And I apologize for mistaking you with another caller that we had on the line, but I appreciate the comment. And I wanted to give Board Member Cohen a chance to respond to your point about adding a bureaucracy on top of the existing police structure. So, Board Member Cohen, did you want to respond to Melissa's point on that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if I did a very good job of articulating exactly what's happening. I guess it's a bureaucratic structure, meaning tax dollars are paying for it. But what it is an entity that polices the police, that interfaces with community and community-driven initiatives. That's independent. That's taking officers, particularly the bad apples that we always hear about, and prosecuting them. And that's just a point of clarification that I wanted to make. I also wanted to affirm something that Kat Brooks said. About initiatives coming from the ground up and coming from the community. I think that's incredibly important, and turning neighborhood watch programs into neighborhood empowerment zones. I think what there should be penalties, fines, stiff fines assigned to people that call the police to try to get Black people in trouble. We saw it in San Francisco, Pacific Heights late last week. A man was stenciling Black Lives Matter on his property, and a white woman said, "Do you live here?" and then called the police. The woman that called the police in the Central Park situation a few weeks ago. I mean, there should be penalties for these kinds of erroneous calls. Also, another initiative I think that would be a complement to what I'm hearing from the community is when police don't always need to respond to everything. If someone was barbecuing in the park, but not necessarily needing a police response, we need to kind of change our framework, and instead of police being warriors, but being more going back to being protectors of safety for everyone. So those are a few of my thoughts that I just wanted to get out there. Thanks, Ethan.
No, thank you. And I want to thank Melissa for calling in. Let's go to another caller. We have Kolya on the line from San Francisco. So Kolya, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, I kind of want to mention here that I saw a documentary on YouTube a number of years ago, an hour one, looks credible, and there were, it's about Norway, their basic criminal justice system involving the police and prisons and all that. The prisons look like hotels, essentially like resorts, no bars on the windows. You know, the wardens dress in casual wear, and they make friends and, you know, play sports with the inmates. And they have an attitude there that, you know, and by the way, there's been no records of recidivism. And I think that the idea there is the working together with the community and showing kind of respect for people, you know, who break the laws and try to rehabilitate. And they don't do so much policing as much as sort of like a kind of a social, you know, psychological counseling, that sort of thing. So I want to kind of mention that people might want to go on YouTube and look up the prison system in Norway. It's very fascinating.
Well, so thank you, Kolya, for alerting us to that example. And Kat Brooks, on that point, are there models around the world that you're looking to in your advocacy, things that you would like to see done in Oakland, maybe inspired by some of the examples around the world?
Look at Norway. That's what I was going to say.
But first, I think it's really important to understand the way that the criminal injustice system was formed in this country. The caller, Melissa, wasn't incorrect in that the first police were slave catchers. And so that is the foundation of policing as we know it. And then once slavery was over, you know, we had the work farms where you could be put there as punishment with basically just continued slavery. And then from there, we had the development of the prison system. So the policing and incarceration system of this country has always been race-based, and it's always been about incarcerating and controlling Black populations. But there are models all over the world. There are models in this country. In Oregon, there's a model called CAHOOPS that's been in existence for quite some time, where police aren't called a mental health crisis, but a team of volunteers and mental health professionals are called. That's not necessarily transferable because 99.9%, I'm exaggerating, but it's not a very diverse community, right? There's lots of white folks there. APTP, we've launched a model in Sacramento called MH First that's going very well. In Iceland, they've got, it's an ambulance, but it doesn't look like an ambulance. And when you're inside, it's like got couches and water and tea. And so if you're having a mental health crisis, you can call them. They're
wow.
Careful to show up, yeah, and you know they get taken for a ride, and well, it's assessed. Like, is this a long term issue? Is this a short term issue? Are you even having a mental health crisis? Because there are certain diseases and spikes, you know, in certain conditions that can replicate a mental health crisis. So
yeah,
there are models that
I look at it this way: that, you know, instead of this punitive mentality, especially here in the States, that you have to have more of a sort of a rapport with people who, you know, the criminals and stuff, and they're able to be turned around to be productive people of society. And I think that must be recognized here in the States and not criminalize everything.
I mean, I don't even like to use the word criminalize, and that's the other reason why I want to go back to this idea of investing in resources, because the thing is,
yeah,
is that if people cannot make a living in the above-ground economy, they're going to make a living in the below-ground economy, right? And the majority of people that are locked up in our prisons, our jails, are people that are there for what we call survival crimes, right? They're robbing, or they're stealing, or they're doing whatever they need to do so that they can put food on the table. Or they're there because we have a messed-up mental health system, and there's not quality support, and so they end up in Alameda County Jail, or they're there because they're dealing with substance abuse and treatment issues because they're dealing with trauma, and you can't be Black or brown or indigenous in this country and not be traumatized. So just addressing those things, we would immediately see a decrease in a need for police, and we'd see an immediate decrease in the overflowing of our jails and prisons.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, caller, for that question. I want to make sure we give another caller a chance to call in. So we've got Matt calling in from Berkeley. Welcome to City Visions, Matt. What's your question for the panelists?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a few suggestions. I think another reform that would have to be included is sanctions for prosecutors, prosecutorial malfeasance. Anybody who knows criminal defense attorneys or people from the public defender's office, they know that, or if you just read articles, prosecutors do a lot of dirty tricks, including withholding exculpatory evidence, and there just never seems to be any consequences for those people. So there needs to be, you know, consequences for that. And then also for police, when they kill somebody unjustly or, you know, beat somebody's head in unjustly, it's always the taxpayer who ends up paying millions of dollars. So what about the idea we as drivers, if we get tickets, our insurance goes up. So why don't cops pay for their own liability insurance? And if they beat up somebody and have to pay out a million, you know, it's on them. And so they're less likely to abuse people if their liability insurance goes up. And then thirdly, I think a lot of times you have police in, say, in Oakland, San Francisco, you know, urban areas, and these police can come from wherever. And a lot of times they haven't had meaningful contact with African Americans. They might have grown up in a community where there aren't a lot of African Americans. And, you know, everybody's subject to media concepts. And a lot of times African Americans are portrayed in crime shows as criminals and all that. So I think it'd be wonderful if cops in urban areas first had to do some, as part of their training while they're in the academy or something, they also have to do some other kind of job. Maybe they're working in schools as teacher's assistants or something, such that their contact with communities from that they're not from, whether it's African-Americans or Latinos or Asians or whatever, or just people from a different city from the environment they grew up in. So they have interactions based on all kinds of, you know, whether it's teaching or coaching or whatever, that is not related to law enforcement, where they get to know people. All right, Matt, outside of the content.
You've raised a number of good suggestions here. I want to make sure we have time for our guests here to respond. So, Board Member Cohen, let me just direct some of Matt's ideas to you.
And maybe thank you. I appreciate
community
that.
Into the mix as well.
Because I think Matt is actually hitting on something that's really important. That's also an initiative that we are looking to implement here in San Francisco. Like you said, people who may not be exposed or be unfamiliar or uncomfortable or for whatever reason with the African-American or Latino community, should they be policing? We are becoming of like mind here in San Francisco that the answer may be no, or that there needs to be a certain level of training or onboarding to bring some cultural sensitivity and understanding together collectively, so that people are not policing and being fearful of stereotypes, the big black man or the angry black woman. So I actually think that Matt has tapped into something that's very salient.
All right. Well, I've got about just about a minute left on this, and I just want to give Matthew and Kat a chance to weigh in. And so, Matthew, I'll start with you just in about 30 seconds. What would be your sort of top two or three, if you could squeeze them in, reforms that you would like to see put in place?
Well, sure. I mean, I think we need changes in law with respect to the use of force and holding officers accountable. We need to get rid of what's called qualified immunity, which is a huge barrier. We need to eliminate the really corrosive and detrimental effects of police unions on accountability and on officer performance. And I think third and most important, we need to comprehensively assess our system of public safety. You know, just because the United States had chosen mistakenly to do policing in the way that we've inherited it, does not mean that we are consigned to do that ad nauseum, that we just have to repeat the mistakes of yesterday. So I'm encouraged by the types of conversations that are happening in San Francisco about how we can provide public safety services, how we can provide for community well-being in a fundamentally different and transformed way.
And Kat Brooks, same question for you. What would be your top asks for reform at this point?
I agree with everything that Matt said. And then I would just say we need to disentangle police from being the answer to every social ill. So comprehensive audits of police functions. And if it doesn't require a badge and a gun, to take the resources that fund those things and redirect them to community members that can take that stuff on. And then the other thing is rooting out racist cops, right? Like, you should not be able to hang out with skinheads on Saturday or post, you know, racial slurs on your Facebook page on Sunday and then go work in the Oakland Police Department on Monday.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank all of our guests for joining me tonight. Matthew Barge, police practices and civil rights expert at 21CP Solutions. Thank you for joining. And also Kat Brooks, co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project. And finally, board member Malia Cohen, former San Francisco supervisor and current president of the California State Board of Equalization. Thank you all so much for joining us to discuss this important issue.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And coming up next, we're going to have a conversation with Oakland-based artist and activist Ori Original. Ori Original is here with us tonight on City Visions. Ori is an Oakland-based activist and artist whose Justice for Our Lives portrait series depicts people who have been killed by the police. The images have been reproduced on T-shirts, held at rallies, even projected on the front of San Francisco's Grace Cathedral. He's with us tonight to talk about his art and activism. Welcome, Ori.
Hi, can you hear me?
We got you. Glad you can join us here on City Visions. So, Ori, can you tell us about the Justice for Our Lives series? What was the first portrait that you did, and how did this all come about?
Yeah, it was in 2014 after attending the annual vigil that they have for Oscar Grant at the BART station. I came back home and decided to do a portrait of his, just something really quick to put out there. I just kept on going with other portraits in the same style. And then I just realized that I had a project going. That was also met with seeing other people engage with the project, or even getting requests from family members for portraits as well. So it's something that just kind of like just grew organically. And this was also right after the inception of Black Lives Matter, which started like in 2013.
And of course, this is a radio, so listeners can't actually see your portrait. So can you describe them for listeners, and also if it's possible to view them online where they could see some of the portraits that you've done? Because it's a very distinctive style.
Yeah, so they're black and white portraits, thick outlines, and so they're all consistent with that style. It's 100 portraits that I'm working on. I'm like at about 85 now. So I've been working on this, yeah, for like about 6 years, I believe now it's been. You've probably seen the portraits of like Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, which were the most prominent in them, you know, being reproduced in shirts or being seen at rallies and whatnot. But I've also done like most recently of George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, which you've probably seen we pasted around Oakland recently. But if you would like to see them online, then you could go to justiceforourlives.com, where I have these designs available for free download. That's where you can go.
Well, and you mentioned your portrait of George Floyd was, and I mentioned it was that one of your portraits was projected on San Francisco's Grace Cathedral, and it was that portrait of George Floyd. So I'm guessing listeners probably have seen it. They have been reproduced across the country and even as far away as Paris. And does the fact that, you know, your portraits are putting a face to this issue and we've seen increased visibility, does that give you any cause for optimism that maybe we're at an inflection point now on this issue?
Yeah, of course. With everything that's going on right now, this is definitely the boiling point, it seems like. And of course, with art, it's something that definitely needs to be at the forefront as well. So it's good to see that there's a lot of artists that are stepping up. Like, even if you drive around, I would imagine in every city, but especially here in Oakland, where every shop has, or not every shop, but there's a lot of shops that are boarded up, and there's a lot of artists that are coming out and doing Black Lives Matter related artwork. So it's definitely needed right now.
And I want to ask you about the families of the victims of the folks that you're portraying through your art. How have they reacted? How have they received your work? What have your dealings been with them?
I've tried my best with most of these portraits to be in contact with them, at least to like get the blessing to be able to produce their portrait, especially if it's of those who don't get like in the front page of the newspaper, or you know, like are in that are really talked about much. So I definitely try to be accountable to them, and make sure that I represent these portraits in the best way possible. So I try to be very careful, you know, because you're dealing with deep emotions that I, of course, don't understand. I can only imagine how tough it might be to lose a loved one, and but then also to be able to get the support, especially through art, I'm sure is something that is very meaningful.
Well, and I know that you don't sign your portraits, so there's an anonymity to what you're doing. But I am curious if social justice is a common through line in the work that you do, and what else you have on tap in addition to this portrait series.
Well, so with these portraits, I do offer them, of course, for free download. There's sort of like open source, where I encourage people to even alter the image if they wish. I don't even necessarily view it as like artwork. Like, I'm not the type of or I don't have any plan to like make reproductions of these and edition them in a way that would make them like have some sort of value in that sense of like maybe like purchasing them. I see these more as just like information that people can use in many ways, of course, at rallies or even in the classroom or in art galleries. So that's the reason for that. But as far as what do I have coming up, I do plan to finish this project at 100 portraits and then make a book out of this whole experience. So that's something that I'm looking forward to.
Thank you so much, Ori, for the work that you do to memorialize these victims of police violence. And we look forward to seeing more of your work, and great to know it's coming out as a book. And thank you for joining us on City Visions.
Thank you.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. We're also joined by Matthew Barge, civil rights expert at 21CP Solutions, Kat Brooks, co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, and Malia Cohen, president of the California State Board of Equalization. And you just heard from Ori Original, Oakland-based activist and artist. Thanks so much for joining me this evening. Our new time, 6 o'clock Monday night. Write it down. Mark it in your calendars. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. We hope you'll join my co-host Joseph Pache next week for a discussion about achieving racial equity and justice with Dr. Lori Watson of Cal State Hayward. And just a note that all the musical interludes tonight have been by Black Violin, and we're leaving you tonight with their rendition of the song One Step. Good night. Thanks so much. Stay safe. Yeah. Lost, but I still want. One step to the future. Step to the